So this is the content of my talk. So these two subjects are about merging. But after that, I'd like to make some comments on scalar graviton. Then, if I have time, I'd like to talk about something about black holes and stuff. So let me begin with the generation of scalar invariant perturbation from non-inflationary space. Okay. This is based on this paper. So to begin with, let me remind you the power counting normalizability and the scaling dimension and so on. Okay. This is very simple, and probably I don't need to do that, but just to remind you. Okay. So let's suppose we have some scalar field, phi. And the kinetic term includes something like this, pi dot squared. And usually in Lorentz invariant theory, we just, in order to calculate the assigned scaling dimension of phi, we just multiply time coordinate and the space coordinate with the same, number, say d. Okay? Then, assuming that the phi is scaled in this way, where s is some number, and demanding that this kinetic term is invariant under scaling, we get s equal minus 1. Okay. Just in case, let's do that. Okay. From dt, we get 1 because t goes like dt. Okay. And from volume integral, we have 3. And from 2 time derivative, we have minus t. Then from 2, 5, we get 2s. And they must sum up to 0. Then we get minus 1. So scalar fields scales like energy. So when we consider this kind of interaction, this interaction behaves like this when we change the energy scale. Okay. Here, this minus comes from this minus, and this one comes from dt, and from volume integral we have 3, and from n5 we get ns. Then, because s is minus 1, the if n is less than or equal to 4, this number, including minus, is non-positive, so that we have good control at high energy. So this is a renormalizability condition in the power counting sense. Okay. In the case of gravity, the action is highly nonlinear in graviton, so that the gravity is non-renormalized. So we don't have good control. I mean, n is much higher than 4. Okay. So the idea of Hochapa is to abandon the Lorentz symmetry to get power counting normalizability. Okay. So let's consider the same scalar field phi. We have phi dot square in the axiom. But we have different scaling. Okay. This number and this number does not have to be the same. So let's consider t goes to d to z, okay, where d is some number. Then the scaling law for the scalar field is determined in this way. From dt, we get z because t goes to d, t is multiplied by d to z. Okay. From volume integral, we have 3. And from 2 time derivative, we have minus 2, minus 2z. And from 2, 5, we get 2s. They must sum up to 0. Then we get this formula. Interestingly, s is 0 if z equals 3. This is how z equals 3 scaling comes from. So as in the previous example with z equal 1, in this case we have this operator behaves like this. This minus z comes from this minus z, and from dt we get z because of this scaling, and from volume integral we have 3, and from n5 we get n. Okay. In the case of z equals 3, s is 0, and this does not depend on n. So for any n, this is this number including minus z is negative. So we have good control, namely renormalizability. Okay. So that if gravity has this kind of scaling, gravity may become renormalized. This is the idea. Very simple. So I'd like to apply this idea to cosmology. Okay. Namely, I'm in particular the generation of cosmological perturbation. Okay. So let me remind you how things work in the case of z equal 1 in the Lorentz invariant theory, how to generate cosmological perturbation. So when we consider cosmological perturbation, we decompose perturbation into Fourier mode, and each Fourier mode has frequency omega, and also the background has an expansion. So the there is a Hubble parameter, namely Hubble expansion rate, how fast the expansion is. Okay, when frequency is much larger than Hubble expansion rate, the mode which we are considering does not feel the expansion, so it just oscillates. On the other hand, if Hubble parameter is large, the Hubble friction is so strong that the mode cannot oscillate, just freeze. Okay. The generation of cosmological fluctuation is happening in this way. Namely, that starting from oscillation, if the mode freezes out, in this case, we generate cosmological perturbation. This happens if the Hubble parameter divided by frequency is increasing in time. Okay. So by by substituting this formula, so omega squared is proportional to k squared, physical wave number squared. But the physical wave number is diluted as the universe expands. So this is proportional to proportional to a to minus two. Okay, so by substituting this to this condition, we get this condition. Namely, the second derivative of scale factor of the universe must be positive. Namely, the universe expansion of the universe must be accelerated. So this means that generation of superhorizon fluctuation requires accelerated expansion, namely inflation. That's why we need inflation to generate cosmological perturbation. Okay. Also, the observation suggests that fluctuation is almost scale invariant. The scale invariance also requires inflation as follows. Okay. So the as we already saw, the scaling law implies that phi scales like energy. So the fluctuation of phi should be proportional to energy scale of the problem we are considering. Okay. And we are considering cosmology. So energy scale is set by Hubble expansion rate. So the quantum amplitude of quantum fluctuation phi should be proportional to h. This agrees with the standard result. And of course, h divided by 2 pi is Hawking temperature. Okay. Now, we want to have scale invariant perturbation. Namely, the amplitude of perturbation with defined scales must be the same. But the perturbation at different scales is generated at different times in cosmology. So that this must be constant in time. Hubble parameter must be constant. But when Hubble parameter is constant, we have exponential expansion, because Hubble parameter is A dot over A. So we have inflation, exponential expansion.
Once you argue that delta phi scales like E, then the next step. What were the words that went with that?
So that E represents energy scale of problem which we are considering. And we are now considering cosmology. And in this setup, the energy scale is set by Hubble expansion rate. We are considering freedom and universe. And on top of that, we are considering scalar field. So the energy scale must be given by Hubble parameter. There is no other scale. So this agrees with the usual formula. So let's consider P equals 3 case. This condition is the same. We want to have oscillation followed by freeze out. So the Hubble square divided by omega square must be increasing in time. But omega square is different from this one. Okay. We now have z equals 3, so omega square must be proportional to k to 6, and proportional to inverse of a to 6. Okay. By substituting this into this formula, we get this condition. So the second derivative of volume must be positive. So So if we consider Pauli expansion, then P must be larger than 1/3, but does not have to be larger than 1. In the previous example, where z equals z, z equals 1, if we consider Pauli expansion, P must be larger than 1 to get accelerated expansion. But we don't need to do, we don't need to have P larger than 1. P smaller than 1 is okay if it is larger than 1/3. Okay. Also, the scale invariant fluctuation does not require inflation if z equals 3, because phi does not scale. So the fluctuation of phi should be proportional to e to 0, which is constant. Okay. So the fluctuation, amplitude of fluctuation does not depend on the energy scale, namely Hubble parameter. So even if the Hubble parameter changes, we still have scale invariant perturbation. So we don't need to have inflation to get scale invariant automatical perturbation. Very simple. And we can check this statement by, solving the model equations and calculating the power spectrum and so on. The result completely agrees with this expectation. Yeah.
Power of k being 6. What if it were 4?
Then we have, I think, blue spectrum. For example, yeah.
And if it were 8?
More blue.
You just want the scalar field to be dimensionless.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's what your argument is. So what
yeah,
pick
right.
your z
three.
Such that this happens.
Yeah. Only for z equals 3.
Yeah.
This is scaling invariant. But of course, if we have inflation, then any value of z gives scaling invariant. But in this case, we don't have to consider inflation.
Sorry, just to be sure. The k to the 6th term dominates only at the.
That's right.
At the
yeah,
high,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
As long as yeah. you are some Planckian.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
The other
is,
terms
will. Okay. Yeah. Good question. Always will be answered in this. So the horizon, this axis is the scale factor, the size of the universe in the log. Okay. This axis is the scale of perturbation. In log scale. So the wavelength of perturbation of interest is goes like this. It's just the proportion of A. And the fluctuation freaks out when H is approximately equal to omega. This happens along this line. So when Hubble is much, let's start with this. Okay. When Hubble is much lower than M, and where M is crossover scale, the sound, this is I would like to call it sound horizon. And the sound horizon agrees with the Hubble horizon, usual case. So this tilt is steeper than this. So the fluctuation always goes in, not go out, if T is smaller than 1. Okay. On the other hand, when Hubble is larger than M, tilt changes. Okay. And the fluctuation can go out from inside to outside. Okay. So that here we have oscillation, and here we have freeze out. After a while, fluctuation goes into our horizon, and we observe by CMB or
why shouldn't it be an
interpolation
between?
Of course, I'm exaggerating. Yeah. There is some, transition, but it is short in general. So that, this is asymptotically of this.
Is it phi that's the scale invariant or the curvature
that's the next? This is scale invariant perturbation of scalar field. So that, your question is answered in the next So the perturbation of scalar field can be converted to the density perturbation by curvature mechanism or those modulated decay. Then we observe curvature perturbation here and also the temperature fluctuation by change. This is very simple idea. And that's it. So if you have a question about this idea, okay, so let me go on to the next. Okay, next I'd like to talk about
something similar to that model. Okay. So this is the result of projectability condition. And in the previous example, I consider cosmological implication of vehicle 3 scale. Now I'd like to talk about the implication of projectability condition. Okay. So let me remind you the structure of GR. Okay. We have four. Okay. Sure.
The dynamics, which was Lipschitz type,
yeah,
but you kept the gravitational dynamics the normal type, or can you change
doesn't
that
matter,
as well?
Doesn't matter. I mean, so the,
how about this step?
Yeah, because I mean, so after I mean, so okay, so here we have this type scaling, okay, and result, and after I mean, exiting the sound horizon, the fluctuation freed out, and after a while, we have a transition from UV to IR regime. And here we have usual gravity.
And so as long as this transition is taking place when the scale is much larger than the Planck scale, then the conclusions will hold. Because the correction terms will be suppressed by wavelength.
Yeah, so the Carleton mechanism or modular decay works in a usual way. And it may work even in the UV scale, UV regime, but no one has analyzed it. So let me go on. So that in GR, we have four dimensional diffeomorphism. So that we have four constraints, namely Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint. I mean, this is zero zero component of Einstein equation, and this is zero I component of Einstein equation. And they must be satisfied at each time, each point. And as you know, the constraints are preserved by dynamical location, namely IJ components of Einstein equation. So as far as initial condition satisfies the constraints, we can forget about it later. We can just solve the dynamical equation. Then the constraint equations are satisfied at rate time automatically. This is the structure of GR. Okay. So let me show you this in the simplest example, namely the Friedman and Watson Walker space time. So this is a scale factor, and this is time, and this is space. Okay, of course this approximates overall behavior of our part of the universe, which is finite. Of course, the size of observable universe is finite, and we don't know what happens outside the horizon. Right? For example, if we consider landscape, then we have many parts. Many universe, and we know only one of them. But this approximates just one of them, namely our universe. And so the Hamiltonian constraint gives us the so-called Friedman equation. This is the first order equation for the scale factor. Okay. And the equation of motion for matter gives us conservation equation, where rho is energy density. Okay. So if we have n species, we have n plus one equation. So that's enough.
Condition somehow assumed?
I don't assume anything. You can if you are right. Yeah. I don't need any energy condition. This is just GR.
Okay.
So the you have just a usual story. And but of course we have the dynamical equation, but this is not the the IJ component of Einstein equation. This is not independent. So we can derive this from the n plus 1 equation. This is a usual story in GR. Okay, let's go on to the observable gravity. In this theory, the fundamental symmetry is polarization preserving detail. This is three-dimensional spatial diffeomorphism plus space-independent time repolarization. So we have less symmetry. As a result, we have three local constraints coming from three-dimensional spatial detail, plus one global constraint coming from space-independent boundary region. So the momentum constraint should be satisfied at each time, each point. They are local constraints. Okay. On the other hand, Hamiltonian constraint associated with this symmetry is global. So that this is satisfied at each time, but this is integrated over whole space. So that we don't have local Hamiltonian constraints. But these
structure are the same as here. Namely, the constraints are preserved by dynamical equation. So that if the initial condition satisfies these constraints, we can forget about it. We can just solve dynamical equation, which are local. So that there is no non-local interactions and so on. Although, Hamilton constraint is equation integrated over whole space. Okay. Now, let's consider the simplest case, namely the Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime. Again, this just approximates overall behavior of our part of the universe, which is time. Okay. There is no local Hamiltonian constraint. Also, the global Hamiltonian constraint say anything, does not say anything about our universe, because our universe is finite. And integration over whole space does not restrict how universe should behave inside our universe, our part of the universe, because our part of the universe is finite. Okay. So there is no Friedman equation. But we still have equation of motion of matter, so we have conservation equation. Also, we have dynamical equation. Okay. So although we don't have Friedman equation, we have enough number of equations. If we have n components, we have n plus one equation for n plus one variables. That's enough. But this is second order equation. Okay. But still we can integrate this equation to get first order equation. Okay. This is very similar to Friedman equation, but we have extra term. Because by going from second order equation to first order equation, we have integration constant. This is a integration constant, but this is proportional to one over a cube. So this is like dark matter. So dark matter appears as integration constant.
Integration constant. It can be positive or negative. But I talk about how to give this as a.
You have positive people.
And I don't know. But I'll talk about it later. But yeah, I want to make this to be positive in our universe, at least. Okay.
So. She says the global is not leading any equation, but if you just confine yourself in particular Kermorian volume, you should still give you some information.
No, because we don't know what happens outside our part of the universe.
Yeah, but I just formulated my theory in a particular Kermorian volume, finite Kermorian volume.
The global Hamiltonian constraint is equation over whole space, vision far away from our part of the universe.
But can you just
let's postpone this discussion later because we have more equations.
It's just what the scene.
So let's consider a more general case. Okay, in the IR limit. The action of photoelectric gravity looks like this. This looks like GR if lambda equal 1. So let's assume that lambda equal 1 is an IR fixed point of algebra flow, so that at low energy, lambda is essentially 1. This is the assumption. Okay. Now, but there is a big difference. The n is function of time. So the Hamiltonian constraint is global. And it is of this form. Here, this is nothing but Einstein equation. This is a four-dimensional Einstein itself. This is the cosmological constant term. And this is a T mu coming from matter. Okay. And N mu is a unit vector perpendicular to the constant time surface. So this is this part is zero-zero component of Einstein equation. But this must be integrated over whole space. Okay. On the other hand, the momentum constraint and dynamical equation are the same as GR. So this is a zero I component of Einstein equation, and this is IJ component of Einstein equation. These are the same as in GR. Okay. Surprisingly, we can find a general solution to these equations. But that, actually, this is kind of trivial, as you see. Let's define THL mu nu by this equation. This is a definition of this tensor. Okay. So that if THL is zero, we have usual Einstein equation. But we can define
THL as a deviation from the usual GL. Okay. Then by substituting this into these two equations, we can see that THL has zero, I mean, so the I zero component of THL must vanish. Also, the IJ component of THL must vanish. So all we have is zero zero component. So as a general solution to momentum constraint and dynamic coefficient, we have this expression, where n mu is, as I explained before, the vector perpendicular to constant time surface. So this is just zero zero component, and this is some scale. Okay. Now, because n is a function of time, we can show that this vector follows geodesic equation. So that this is like a duct, namely CDM. So pressureless duct. Okay. We still have Hamiltonian constraint, but this is integrated over whole space. And this says that the energy density, I mean, this is like energy density of duct-like component, integrated over whole space must vanish. But this does not say that rho HL in our universe, in our part of the universe, should vanish. Namely, the rho HL can be positive everywhere in our part of the universe, as far as it is cancelled by contribution from outside of our part of the universe. So, yes.
Negative density does?
I don't think so. I mean, as far as total energy density is positive everywhere. I mean, if suppose we have a positive energy, rho HL inside our universe, and a very thin, I mean, small negative value outside, and if they sum up to zero, it's okay. And if we have, say, cosmic constant, small cosmic constant, then energy density, total energy density, can be positive everywhere. So there's no problem. Also, we can get the kind of conservation equation from taking divergence of this equation. By taking divergence, we get zero from Bianchi identity. Divergence of Einstein equation, Einstein tensor is zero because of Bianchi identity. And the divergence of G mu is zero. So we get this equation, where this derivative is derivative along n mu, and the time derivative. K is trace of extinct surface. The right hand side is given by the divergence of T mu nu of matter. Namely, if matter satisfies conservation equation, this is there. If not, we have a source term. In a more general case, we have something like this. The left hand side is the same. This is the same as before. But we have a contribution from lambda minus 1. If lambda deviates from 1, the diffeo is broken, and it contributes to the right-hand side. Also, higher curvature terms contributes to the right-hand side. So in the R universe, all terms are turned on and contributes to the dark matter. So my scenario is as follows. So in the R universe, suppose rho HL is zero. And in the R universe, we can generate cosmic perturbation in matter sector and gravitational wave. The cosmological perturbation includes many scales. I mean, small scale and large scale, and even the scales much longer than our universe, right? So that we have long scale fluctuation of the right hand side. It generates the long scale perturbation of dark matter automatically. They are correlated. Okay. So that we have a large patch of positive rho HL and large patch of negative rho HL. Yeah.
The sign of the source term somehow.
What's it?
Yeah. So why would we produce a large patch of rho with one sign instead of of varying?
Right. Time? Right. So the right hand side is oscillating initially, in the early universe when the fluctuation is inside the sound horizon, but the fluctuation when fluctuation exists. The sound horizon, the fluctuation fades out.
on the right-hand side of right-hand side is fixed. At that time, the left-hand side is generated. After that, after a while, the hyperparameter becomes small enough, then the right-hand side is turned off. So that, but so we go back to the this, I mean, the same here. So the right-hand side is zero, so we have, I mean, conservation equation for that one.
Yeah, but I still don't see why, what would make the all the row that we see that re-enters the horizon be
positive?
Yeah, why wouldn't it be alternating in sign?
Yeah, so the, I'm assuming that the I mean, so we have, yeah, it depends on the spectrum. Yeah, so if we have large enough amplitude for the large scale fluctuation, then the, we have large scale fluctuation and small wavelength. And we are living here.
So I guess Ted's question is that why aren't we living in a region with negative?
Oh, I don't know.
So that's an anthropic.
Yeah.
There's an anthropic principle.
It's not be an anthropic argument, right?
Yeah. So if rho HL is negative, then the structure formation is suppressed.
Yeah. So therefore, we are not here.
Yeah. but the point is that we can and in principle we can calculate the physical amplitude. Not the exact amplitude because we don't know where we are in, but we can calculate the physical amplitude.
Just a comment actually on. So when one looks at large field inflation from general initial conditions, that's exactly this kind of argument which one uses. When there's a spectral fluctuation, small wavelengths, large wavelengths, if one has enough power in the large wavelength modes, then one gets inflation
right,
as
right,
a local
right,
attractor.
Right.
And you're using this same mechanism.
I see. So that's also an anthropic argument.
Well, no, I view it as a local attractor mechanism, not as an anthropic argument.
What are these order lambda minus one terms?
Order? Yeah.
Well, we've got the lambda minus one. What are they?
Oh, I see. So here we have scalar gradient contribution from scalar gradient. And yesterday, Paul explained the strong coupling between the matter and the scalar gradient. We can understand that in this language. So he talked about the non-projective version. In the a projective version, there is no such a strong coupling. But if we consider non-projective version, we have local Hamiltonian constraint. Namely, rho HF is exactly there, everywhere, every time. That is Hamiltonian constraint, global Hamiltonian constraint. So if we set left-hand side to be zero, and send lambda to one, here we have a scalar gradient. So the scalar gradient is strongly created, generated, because of violation of, I mean, conservation law, if we impose local Hamiltonian constraint. But in this case, without local Hamiltonian constraint, it just generates low HL. There's no problem. There's no strong coupling between matter and scalar gravity. Of course, we have strong self-coupling of scalar gravity, but that is another story. So I hope that I convinced you that overall behavior of smooth PHL mu nu is like pressureless stuff. So this is like TDM. So what happens if we consider microscopic lumps of low HL? I think they can collide and bounce, and they can form caustics and so on. And today we heard about early universe bounce. So I think something similar happened for the, I mean, collision of microscopic lumps of low HL.
Because you think it? Because you calculated something?
No, I think so. I just, this is just conjecture.
Have a feeling.
Yeah, this is just conjecture.
So this rho ratio comes out as an integral constant.
Let me explain in this way. So in Poisson gravity, we just have a scalar gravity and tensor gravity and matter. That's all. And we have just the I mean, momentum constraint, dynamic equation, and the global hamming constant gravity. Okay. We can just set up initial condition so that the initial condition satisfies constraints. We just throw dynamic equation. That's it. There is no need to introduce dark matter. Right. But when we compare the result of calculation with GR, there is something different. Because initially, I mean, even if the local Hamiltonian constraint is satisfied at initial time, it is violated at rate time. So there is some difference between result in GR and result in positive gravity. And we can understand the result as time does not. That's what I'm saying. So we don't have, I mean, if we don't know GR, if we know only positive gravity, we don't have to introduce dark matter. Right? But we want to compare the result with result in GR. Anyway, we want to understand the result in the language of GR. Yeah, sure. At that time, when we try to interpret the result, dark matter appears.
Yeah, sure, but,
in the dynamics, there is no need to introduce dark matter.
Sure, but at this point, it is purely classical. So,
I think this structure, passes even in quantum level. We can just,
this is the charge associated with the time reparameterization events. But that brings me to another question. So, or even in GR, it's true that Hamiltonian is a straight boundary, but if you're actually careful about derivatives, then there is a boundary term as well, and when you integrate it up, you get something that's non-zero, because it's essentially the ADM mass. Mm-hmm. And if you have an SPW class, that integral is non-zero,
because
there's a boundary term.
Yes, yeah.
So you're saying it's zero because you're just ignoring the boundary.
Right. Well, I'm constantly compacting.
Yeah.
Compact but large enough.
Yeah. But if there are cases which you could imagine it's not.
Yeah.
So just maybe you'll anticipate this later, but what are the actual constraints on having this rho HL positive within our horizon? Maybe there's negative rho HL creating voids or some crazy thing, right? Is that ruled out?
Yeah, as far as total energy density is positive.
Yeah, okay, maybe the total, but
yeah.
It's, I think what Ted said, why couldn't we have lumps of negative rho inside our own horizon?
Oh, I see. So if microscopic one.
Well,
yeah.
So microscopic voids. Why can't they just be repulsive rhos that are pushing everything?
Large ones.
Yeah, big ones. Negative energy is anti-gravity, so if you have a hunk of negative rho, it will push stuff away. I mean, maybe it's cosmic voids.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Is this ruled out by anything we know at this point in history?
I don't know. I mean, someone suggested me to consider a void as an explanation of accelerating universe. So, maybe. So that there are some models of inhomogeneous universe where we are living in a center of void. And then we don't need to introduce dark energy. And so someone told me to, consider that kind of possibility, but I don't know. But all I wrote here, just conjecture. And I don't know whether they are correct or not, but I'm guessing what's
happening. Okay, this is one of the good things about all being in the same room. So we don't just read your paper. Why do you make that conjecture? I mean, what's the evidence? Is it just that you think it would be wonderful if it were true? Or is there something more than?
I see. So that for the bounds, I think it is, my guess is based on the robot argument about the.
On that very symmetric solution.
Yeah. But I think that the curvature helps. Because of the curvature and higher curvature terms, plays a role of perfect force.
Actually, I found a paper of yours where you actually did study another example. It was something with planar symmetry.
That's right. Yeah. I think that the most dangerous situation is planar symmetry case. I think the caustic formed, in the direction where the eigenvalue of the sum matrix becomes mostly negative. And so that we have, in general, codimension one caustics. So the codimension one caustics is the most dangerous one. And actually, if lambda is exactly one,
there is no way to avoid caustic, I mean, co-dimension one caustics. And, but if lambda equal is not one, the, that solution disappears, and we can avoid. So the, my guess is that if lambda equal one is an IR fixed point, then the, at low energy, lambda is essentially one, but near the would-be caustics, lambda deviates from one, and avoids the real caustics and the bumps. That's my guess. But we have to do numerical simulation in order to show that.
You have these smooth lamps. Then the
yeah, smooth one is most dangerous.
You can apply, yeah.
I mean, the symmetric case is most dangerous.
But then you can apply perturbation theory to those. And in this case, these perturbations are going to grow.
Yeah, perturbation. Yeah, I think
a balance between everything that in the end you are losing.
I think that the perturbation helps balancing because it contributes to the curvature. I mean, the reason why co-dimension one case is most dangerous is that it does not have curvature. Curvature is exactly zero. So the higher curvature term does not help. Also, if lambda equal one, when we consider this as a matrix, there is one zero eigenvalue. So that is why we don't have, we cannot avoid co-dimension one caustics. I mean, if we have lambda equal one and the co-dimension one caustics, kinetic term vanish, potential term vanish, so there's no way to avoid. But if lambda equal not one, it's not one, then all eigenvalues are not zero. So the as far as eigenvalues are positive, namely that if lambda is larger than one, we have, near the caustics, the kinetic term diverges, so that it helps balance.
So if you have lambda equal to one and you have on this co-dimension one caustic,
what
would the physics look like near that? If you ignore any phenomenological restrictions, what would just happen if you follow the
theoretical? Then I think that extreme scale divergence. I mean one component of extreme scale divergence. So that if it is a real singularity, if lambda is exactly one. But if lambda is not exactly one, in the UV, we can avoid it. Okay. Anyway, so the if the theory is asymptotically free, then this kind of Lucas caustics doesn't gravitate too much. And also, if we consider a group of microscopic lamps with collisions and bounces, then coarse grain, I think this may be a cluster particle in everything is fashion. But there's no evidence for that. I'm just conjecturing for this. Also, what is interesting is that the dispersion relation of matter is defined in some particular rest frame because dispersion relation breaks Lorentz invariance. Also, the dark matter, sort of dark matter has a rest frame mu. These two rest frames exactly agree because of symmetry. We have correlation preserving ratio. Because of that, these two frames exactly agree. So if we consider a situation where dark matter and ordinary matter move very fast. Although, suppose we have a lump of gas, ordinary matter, gas of ordinary matter, and dark matter, they move with each other with very large velocity. Even though the velocity inside the lump of gas is small, that we might be able to see the effect of higher terms in the dispersion ratio. Because the dispersion ratio is defined in the rest frame of dark matter. So if you have any astrophysical situations where we can see this kind of effect, please let me know.
But how can we distinguish that from just interaction with regular dark matter?
I don't know. I haven't yet analyzed it. But this dark matter is kind of illusion. There's absolutely no interaction with my matter. So that
there'd be no cosmic rays.
Hmm?
There'd be no cosmic rays in it.
Yeah, this transformation is different. Yeah, yeah. Changes. So that cosmic ray.
Well, I don't know. Maybe there will be.
Yeah.
Let's
discuss. Yeah, what about particle production? At the would-be cusps.
That's interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd like to consider that situation.
That's very interesting. Okay, how many minutes do you have? Don't worry, I'll do the last. So let me summarize so far. So D equals 3 scaling can solve the horizon problem and leads to scaling invariant optimized perturbation. And also the lack of local Hamilton constraint may explain dark matter without dark matter.
Before you go on, can I ask one question about the first section? Yeah. What about the flatness?
I think it's difficult. Yeah.
What?
I think it's difficult to solve. I mean,
difficult to solve.
Classically, at least.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we need to consider creation of the universe or something. Yeah, if the, I mean, the, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but there are some suggestions about making the flatness problem like milder by using higher curvature terms. Because higher curvature terms, I mean, if z equals 3, curvature terms scales like 1 over a to 6 instead of 1 over a squared. So the curvature terms decay faster in the real universe. So that it may make flatness problem milder. But eventually, the usual 1 over a squared term dominates, I mean, takes over, so that we cannot solve the flatness problem. But may become milder. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
What is this? In your case, is there any chill of your spectrum?
Sorry?
What's the spectral index? Does it have any chill for you?
Yeah. So if we have a, I mean, the anomalous dimension, we can have a chill. But I haven't yet calculated it.
So you have no idea about the sign. You don't know the sign either.
I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So the rest of this talk is, focusing on the some comments on scale direction. And if I have time, probably I don't have time, but yeah. If I have time, I intended to talk about the black holes and stuff. So this is a story which is already known. Okay. So the this starts from Minkowski plus perturbation, and we fix the gauge and solve momentum constraint. Then we have a divergence free component. So we can have two degrees of freedom from TT path, namely usual tensor graviton. And from tensor path, we have 1 degree of freedom, namely scalar graviton. And by plugging this expression into the kinetic term, we get this kind of action, where H tilde is a ordinary tensor graviton, and capital H is a scalar graviton. So that when lambda goes to 1, this disappears, and this is a pure gauge. And the pure gauge with respect to the, I mean, diffeo, three dimensional diffeo. So this is a symmetry. So that this is a pure gauge. So, I mean, it is expected that this decouples from the rest of the world. Yeah. We can normalize the field. But I'd like to consider a situation where lambda is 1 or larger than 1. Yeah, that's one. Yeah. But if lambda is 1/3, we have wild symmetry. Yeah. But between 1/3 and 1, the scalar graviton becomes ghost. So I'd like to consider lambda equal to 1 or larger than 1. Okay. In this case, we have the positive time kinetic term. But when lambda goes to 1, the scalar graviton gets strongly coupled. But this is self-coupling. This is not the coupling between scalar graviton and matter. As I said, there is no strong coupling between scalar graviton and matter. So this is self-coupling. Yeah, we have to show in the nonlinear level, but at least the strong coupling which Paul was mentioning yesterday, you want to hear, you want to hear, yeah. Doesn't exist in the version with projectability condition. Yeah, I'm considering the version with where n is Laplace function time. Then we don't have a local Hamilton constraint, and the violation of conservation law in matter sector does not, produce. Lot of scale graph. But so this is we have to be careful because of this strong coupling. But this is not necessarily a problem
near renormalizable theories if there is one sense X. Namely, that if the strongly coupled sector is decoupled from the other sector, I mean the scalar graviton and tensor graviton and matter sector, I mean, then we can still treat the rest of the world part of it. Namely, in this theory, we have scalar graviton and tensor graviton and matter. And the scalar graviton gets strongly coupled by itself. And if this is decoupled from the rest of the world, we can treat this sector part of it. No. That is what Paul was talking about yesterday, about the version with, non-projectable version. So in that version, there is a strong coupling between matter and the scalar graviton. So that in the binary parser, from the binary parser, scalar graviton is radiated very strongly. But in this case, we don't have that kind of strong coupling. No. I cannot say no, but there is no indication of that.
But I don't think anything that's going to happen.
No. But yeah, right. It's fair to say I don't know. Yeah. But the all claims about strong coupling between scalar graviton and matter does not exist. There is no claim. I mean, quick. No, that's right. Yeah, you are right. Yeah. So that I think this is like a QCD plus QED. I mean, when QCD is strongly coupled, we can still treat QED part of it. So if we want to understand the dynamics of scalar graviton, we have to analyze it non-partitively. But the sector of tensor graviton and matter sector can be treated part of it if there is decoupling. No, I'm saying that the scalar graviton decouples from the tensor graviton and we don't know. We don't know. Yeah, we don't know. But we have to be careful and we have to analyze it. Yeah. No one knows. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But there is no result. Yeah. But no, there is no proof. That's right. Yeah. So no one knows. So we have to. Yeah. They are considering self strong coupling. They are not talking about coupling. No. They don't consider coupling with matter. No. Their analysis cannot say anything about this statement. Yes or no? I mean.
Well, depending on your matter, if you need to have a that would mean that general relativity has to be only plus 12, for example.
No. I mean, so, when QCD decouples, QCD is only coupled, we can still split, plus QED. Okay. Maybe this analogy is not good, but I don't know. Yeah. But yeah. So anyway, yeah. This is open question, and no one knows the answer. Okay. So there is a claim about the linear instability of scalar gravitons. I'd like to comment on this. And the scalar graviton has time kinetic term. I mean, the sign is given by this, as before, this one. Okay. So this must be positive. And the linear dispersion relation is of this form, where sound speed square has negative sign here. So this is negative. So we have IR instability in linear level if lambda, I mean, if this is not there. This was found by Wang and Martin, and discovered by these people. But we already know that we have kind of dark matter, and dark matter develops gene instability. And this is good instability, because gene instability is a source of our structure, I mean, structure of our universe. Without gene instability, we cannot live in this universe, right? Galaxy does not form, we cannot live, our life does not emerge. So the gene instability is important, and so this instability is slower than gene instability. If this time, I'm telling that. Yeah. So gene time scale is given by this, where DNA is Newton constant, and this is energy density of the point of interest, and this is linear time scale given by this. And also, this instability can be tamed by Hubble friction if this is larger than, longer than the Hubble time. Also, this is tamed by higher derivative terms if this is larger than this. Namely, that if L, length scale is shorter than this. Okay? So the linear instability does not show up if this condition is satisfied, where phi is Newton constant. For the background. So that depending on the Newton constant and Hubble parameter and length scale, which you are considering, CF must be small enough. And from my point of view, this instability is not necessarily a problem. This is a phenomenological constraint on properties of RG4. Because the right hand side depends on the point where you are interested in, and also the and this depends on the scale. I haven't yet done so because I just not as small as you said. You considered, I think that you demanded that I forgot. Omega is smaller than Hubble parameter when you put K to the M, right? That is too strong. No. I mean, this is small. Yeah, so that this becomes much earlier. So that this, from that consideration, we get this one. So anyway, we don't know whether this condition is satisfied under RG4. So we have to analyze RG4 very clear. Okay, so
carry on. 5 more minutes.
Okay, we've got time. Okay. So then I'd like to talk about something about black holes and stuff. Some of you know the Schwarzschild geometry in PG coordinate is covering an exact solution if lambda equals 1.
By this PG coordinate?
I'll explain it
later.
So the Lux function is 1. The shift vector is not 0. So even with higher derivative terms, this is the exact solution. Also, car geometry in the so-called Laurent coordinate, this is Gaussian normal coordinate. Namely, Lux function is 1 and shift vector is 0. In this coordinate, the car geometry is, I think, locally an approximate solution, if we consider large enough black hole. Higher power terms becomes important at short scale in this coordinate, but for large black hole, it does not. I think that those solutions are black for low energy probes, but it is not black for high energy probes. So the singularity at the center may become visible.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by the Kerr geometry is an approximate solution if lambda equals 1?
Yeah. Oh, probably lambda doesn't have to be 1. Yeah. Okay, so even what I'm saying here is that even if lambda equals 1, Kerr geometry is not exact solution.
Yeah, why not? I thought that's the GR case.
Higher curvature terms.
Right.
Same with arbitrary higher curvature.
Yeah. So in this case, even with higher curvature terms, this is the exact solution.
Actually,
because in the PG coordinate, the three-dimensional geometry is completely flat. But there is no known BG coordinate for car geometry, there is a Gaussian normal coordinate. In that case, curvature of three-dimensional geometry is not there.
Mm-hmm.
So it contributes.
That's the reason why you cannot run the usual proofs, for example, which tell you that in a broad class of models, let's say ABS would be a solution independent of Hilbert, because you don't have a full to stick to whatever foliage.
Oh, right. We have to specify foliage. But near the center of those solutions, the extreme curvature diverges. So the UVFX becomes important. And the question is whether UVFX can resolve the black hole singularity. And I don't know the answer, as you expect. But to answer this question, we probably need to evolve a regular initial data towards black hole formation. So as a very first step, I'd like to consider stellar solution. Then I found the kind of noble result. But this is not necessarily a problem. I found the noble result for exactly static stuff. I mean, if we demand that the solution is exactly static, then we cannot find a solution.
Static in the preferred frame.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this means that the stellar center should be dynamical. This is what I'm saying. Okay. Let me show you.
Or your foliation is dynamical, not?
Yeah, where it goes.
You have a fixed star, but your foliation.
No. I mean, the geometry is very dynamical. We'll see. Okay, so this is a PG coordinate. Okay, that's function is 1, and shift vector is not there, but depends on only on space coordinate. And this is a special coordinate. So this is static. And the matter sector consists of a perfect fluid and static, because this depends only on space coordinate. So I'm not saying spherical symmetric static, I mean geometry. And Guzai, defined by this, is a Killing vector. Actually, this satisfies Killing equation. So that this is, I mean, time-like vector in the direction of, I mean, Killing vector. Now, I'd like to assume for the proof, for the purpose of proof, that the energy density is piecewise continuous and non-negative function of pressure P. So I'd like to allow kind of safe transition. But
why are you not just taking Schwarzschild-like coordinates?
Because in that case, the Laplace function is function of space. Laplace function must be function of time only in this theory.
In the projectable version.
Yeah.
You need to be in a slicing which has a spatially independent end.
Yeah.
By design.
Yeah. That is requirement from the theory. So also I'd like to assume that the central pressure is positive. This is a technical assumption. Then what I'm going to use is just momentum conservation equation. This does not depend on higher derivative terms. And this is coming from based on the three-dimensional diffeomorphism, so this is exact. There's no contribution from higher derivative terms, and deviation from lambda equal 1 doesn't change this.
I'm confused. Didn't you just prove that you have dark matter essentially, so you have geodesics, so special surfaces are normal to geodesics,
mm-hmm.
And of course we don't have a static geodesics.
That's the intuitive reason.
Okay, so that's
the same. Yeah. So that we just have a time-dependent region near the center. So that this is not the problem of the theory. So I'd like to consider this observational signature for the theory. So that, in order to say something definite, I'd like to say something definite. So that that's why I prove this theory. So the global statistic means that this vector must be time-like everywhere, so that this must be positive. 1 minus beta squared must be positive. Now, the regularity of this intelligence, say the data time is finite. So the this is finite, and this is non-zero. So p prime must be finite. So because they are, I mean, their derivatives are finite, we have beta and p are continuous. Because rho is piecewise continuous function of p, this combination is also piecewise continuous function of x, because px is continuous. Now, this is the assumption, and this is what we got from here. And the rho is non-negative. This is the assumption here, non-negative. And rho plus p is so because of the three conditions, we have positivity of rho plus p near the center, at least. Okay. So let's define x0 as a minimal value for which at least one of these three is non-negative, non-positive. And because I'm considering piecewise continuous function, you have to consider three quantities, the value at that point and the two limits. Then, by dividing this equation by this and this, and integrating over from xc to x0, we get this. Now, left hand side is not positive, because the regularity of curvature and this is curvature say that delta c is zero. This is zero. So this is negative and non-positive. Okay. On the other hand, we can show that the right-hand side is positive. From the definition of x zero, this is the definition of x zero. And this is the assumption, rho is non-negative. And this is from these two, we get this result. P zero is non-positive. So this is positive, and this is non-positive. So right-hand side is positive. So this is contradiction. So there is no spherical symmetric global static solution. The sphere center must be dynamical. So I didn't use anything which depends on higher derivative terms. So this is valid for anything. So I think that this is very interesting observation signature of the theory. So if we, in order to see this kind of effect, we have to know the size of the time dependent region and time scale of the dynamics. And so I don't know, I have no idea. We have to analyze the nonlinear dynamics near the center of the star. And even after that, I don't know what kind of observation we can make. So, if you have any suggestion, please let me know.
It could also be very difficult to see that the time dependence in at the core of the solution, right? Because if the solution is almost like a black hole for low energy excitations, it has an effective horizon. It's only the high energy excitations that
But this is an ordinary star. For example, Newton star, or even the,
sun. Did you wait enough? What? Can you reconcile this with what Niaj said about the?
And I think that near the center of the star, we have sequence of would be cosmics and bounds,
Oh, that's what I was going to say. But then it doesn't make sense. So the thing flows in and flows out.
Something like that. But I have no. I don't know what happens. But at least I can say that. The sphere center must be time dependent.
But everywhere would be time.
Everywhere, yeah.
Maybe. At short scale. But as I said, if we consider, if we consider bound, cosmics and bounds at scale shorter than 0.0 millimeter, a point zero one millimeter, then we don't see. It's like a space time form. We can have a postfix.
But then it wouldn't matter for the star anymore, anyway, right? Because these aren't microscopic scales, they're dynamics, but the star is a big thing.
So yeah. So that maybe that's why I was saying that you have to estimate the size of the
vacuum. Isn't there a conservation? Then you're saying the ether keeps flowing into the middle. Then is it going to pile up there inside some core?
I don't know. From the outside, the amplitude, vector is directing towards the center.
Right.
But amplitude can be zero.
Amplitude of what?
Amplitude of dark matter component. If we set it to be zero. Of course, even in the usual lambda CDM, if we have dark matter, we cannot have a static solution.
What if you set it to be zero everywhere? Then why don't you still don't have a static solution.
No.
Right, so it isn't really an issue. It's not the dark matter that...
Yeah, so I'm trying to answer your what you said about, answer your question about piling up.
Yes.
In order to pile up the energy near the center, you have to send the energy from outside. And if the low energy density of dark matter outside is zero, even though the vector is pointing toward the center, it does not energy density. I don't know, but the energy density may not pile up. Maybe I don't know.
Or the we can talk.
Yeah.
I also have a related question. Is this something that can be attributed to the time dependence and the foliation? In the following sense, that if I'm an observer far away from the star, and I'm oblivious to the fact that there's some different foliation in space-time, I'm just using my conventional GR reasoning. I'm saying I pick a slicing of the space-time in which the solution looks static. Is there such a slicing which might not respect the original preferred foliation, but in which the solution would appear static to the
observer?
You can take a Schwarzschild black hole, you can take a static star and put it in some funny way which makes the solution look time dependent.
Right. So in the gravity sector, a solution is a set of geometry and foliation, as you said. But from the point of view of observer, if I'm considering, I'm a low energy probe, then I guess that the Lorentzian, the diffeomorphism in matter, my sector is, recovered. So the we don't see the preferred frame. We can change, even if we change the coordinate, even if we change the foliation, the physics is the same, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
But it doesn't, how to say?
So the low energy observer of the star might still look static.
Yeah, I think so.
Except for the cross
for
the
star. Yeah,
it's everywhere fine, it's sort of uniform cross extension.
Yeah.
Flashes everywhere by uniform cross. So that kind of
instability.
Okay, so we've got a lot of questions. So I think just thank you for that.